Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. On this show, we have Brad Thompson. Bradley Thompson is from Clemson University, where he's the professor of political science and the director of the Snow Institute for the Study of Capitalism. He has several publications and books and essays about the American Revolution and also about education. But today, he's here to talk to us about his 2019 book, America's Revolutionary Mind, A Moral History of the American Revolution and the Declaration that Defined It. Brad, thanks for being on History 605.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's great to be with you and your audience.
I'm doing a series of shows about the American Revolution, which is outside of the normal subject matter of what I'd cover in a South Dakota history podcast, because of the America's 250th birthday coming up. And your book really caught my attention. As I started reading it, I couldn't help but think of the movie Good Will Hunting. Did you see that film in 97 where he's he's about ready to launch into a bar fight with some snotty grad student? He's just regurgitating all these different schools of thought about why the war started and so forth. And then he razzes him for not having an original thought. And then I thought, I think Brad Thompson has an original thought here.
That's great. I appreciate that very much.
Yeah. So I was wondering, you kind of tee off on something that you said you had seen before that John Adams wrote about what the revolution meant or why it started or how it came about. And I wonder if you can take the listener kind of back to that moment of what John Adams said and why, for some reason, at that particular time, it hit you a different way.
Sure. Well, let me begin by saying that I was just beginning to write what was going to be perfectly honest, a relatively short monograph on the Declaration of Independence. And a month into my research, I reread this famous letter that John Adams wrote to Thomas Jefferson in 1815, where Adams raises the question, what was the American Revolution? Was it the War of Independence? And Adams says, no, it was not the War of Independence. The true American Revolution, he says, was in the minds of the American people. And this was affected in the years between, in the 15 years before Lexington and Concord, which is interesting, it seems to me, on two fronts. First, Adams dates the beginning of the American Revolution to 1760. Most historians of the Revolution typically date the beginning of the Revolution to 1764 with the passage of the Sugar Act by the British Parliament, or 1765, which is the typical dating, which is the year in which the Stamp Act was passed. But Adams dates it to 1760, which is a very curious dating. And it led me to wonder, well, you know, what happened in 1760? And it turns out what happened in 1760 is that British imperial officials began requiring British officials, in particularly in New England, to use what were called general writs of assistance, which is effectively a search warrant. And these new general, keyword is general, writs of assistance, unlike specified writs of assistance, gave police or constables access to essentially any building anytime they wanted. And it lasted, the writ lasted as long as the life of the current king, which meant that a writ of assistance passed after the inauguration of George III could have lasted for another 30 or 40 years. many Boston merchants at this time reacted very strongly against it. And they filed a lawsuit, which went to trial in, I believe, February of 1761. And the attorney defending the merchants was none other than James Otis,
right,
who in many ways was the first great revolutionary. And in that in that courtroom, he gave this wonderful speech, oration, really, against these writs of assistance and in defense of American freedom. And it turns out he had a young assistant lawyer with him at the time to witness this speech. And that young lawyer was none other than John Adams. That's the dating of it. And then the other important thing that Adams notes is that the real revolution was in the minds of the American people. And that was the moment. That's what really set me off on this sort of treasure hunt to look for what I consider to be the real causes of the American Revolution, which were in the minds of the American people. So the question is, what does that mean to say that the revolution was in the minds of the people? In another letter that he writes to Hezekiah Niles 3 years later, Adams says that this revolution in the minds of the American people was a moral revolution. And so that means something happened. Right. Something happened between 1760 and 1775 in the minds of the American people, and more particularly in their moral sentiments. And that was my aha moment when I realized that there was something much bigger and much deeper going on than had generally been considered by most historians of the Revolution. So that's when the book changed from a very short one on the Declaration of Independence to what turned out to be a much, much longer book, which was really on the revolution as a whole. And my book, the title of the book is America's Revolutionary Mind. And the subtitle is A Moral History of the American Revolution and the Declaration that defined it. And I came to the conclusion that the most important factor, the most important causal factor in the coming of the American Revolution was not political factors, it was not economic or religious factors, it was primarily moral factors. And that had to do with the colonists, effectively, let's call it a discovery of the doctrine of natural rights. That was kind of their, as I said, aha moment when they realized that all of these acts being passed by the British Parliament were a violation of their fundamental natural rights.
Which was then the king or parliament acting immorally, essentially.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They come around to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least let's put it this way, that the policies being passed by the British Parliament, which means the sugar stamp, declaratory, Townsend, Tea, and coercive acts that were passed between 1764 and 1774. All of these acts were immoral in some way, in that they violated the rights of the colonists. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that. I mean, see, this is the hard part, because I'm reluctant to say that British parliamentarians were immoral, because the British Parliament was the most enlightened and liberal, by which I mean classically liberal, political legislature in world history. The British Parliament had brought more freedom to Great Britain and then ultimately the rest of the world than any other political body in history hitherto. So, but what's also interesting, and I should mention this because I think this is actually really fascinating. As early as 1765, John Adams wrote a pamphlet titled A Dissertation on the Canon and Feudal Law, at the end of which he accused British imperial officials of, quote, a design to enslave the Americans. Now, this is only after the Sugar and Stamp Acts have been passed, passed by the most enlightened, wise political body in world history. And yet he's accusing them of effectively a conspiracy to take away their rights and liberties. And then throughout the whole the years of the imperial crisis, up until 1776, a number of American revolutionaries, including Thomas Jefferson, made the same charge. In 1774, in his summary view of the rights of British North America, Thomas Jefferson made the very same claim, literally, well, 9 years later, that mm-hmm. that there was a conspiracy of British imperial officials to enslave them. So at the very least, that tells us that in 1765, John Adams was either cuckoo or he was remarkably prescient in being able to see this conspiracy and this design against American liberties.
He might be prescient, but I guess, and you've spoken to this a little bit before, that this is a revolution in the mind of the American people. So clearly that idea that John Adams and his very interesting, some might think more interesting, cousin Sam Adams are wanting to spread this notion that this is a perhaps a moral, as you argue, dilemma or issue. But how does it go from the mind of these two Bostonians into the popular sentiment of the colonists?
You know, one of the remarkable things I think about the American Revolution, and by when I say the American Revolution, I sort of can mean it in different ways. I'm going to speak of the American Revolution as being that period starting in 1760 and really going up through the end of the Revolutionary War, which ends officially in 1783. So, you know, there's something that's going on in American life, in American culture. And, you know, and I think probably the most important thing to say about it is that the American colonists throughout the entire 18th century were literally the freest people in the history of the world. No other people had been as free as the Americans anywhere. And despite the fact that they considered themselves to be loyal subjects of the British realm, they nonetheless saw themselves first and foremost as free. And what happened is that, you know, beginning at the end of the Seven Years' War, which officially ends in 1763, right? The Seven Years' mm-hmm. War is this war that Great Britain had fought against Spain, France, and Spain. It was actually in many ways the world's first world war because it was right. fought in many places around the world. But the primary battleground of the Seven Years' War was in North America. And when the war came to an end, the British treasury, the British won the war. And let's also remember that in certain ways, the war was fought in part on behalf of Britain's American colonists. But sure. at war's end, they were in debt. And so it is the case that British imperial officials, right at the very end of the Seven Years' War, 1763, began to reorganize the British Empire. Up until 1763, for almost the entire 18th century, the British Parliament had the official name for the policy was salutary neglect. Relative mm-hmm. to the colonies. They basically had a laissez-faire, hands-off attitude toward the colonies, which is to say, they, with only a very few rare exceptions, did they legislate for the colonies at all, which meant the colonies were left alone mm-hmm. by the British Parliament on the, let's say, the eastern side. And on the western side, right, there was the frontier. And what happened is with freedom and a frontier, the American people began to develop a culture of self-governance and a culture of freedom. And so when Britain started to reimpose both economic and political control on the colonies, starting in 1764 with the Sugar Act, and then the year later with the Stamp Act, the Americans revolted immediately, right? And it wasn't just at the top end, right? So now finally, to go to the heart of your question, it wasn't just the James Otis's, Sam Adams's, John Adams's, and then later, you know, the Thomas Jefferson's and George Washington's. It was a revolution in the minds of ordinary, mm-hmm. everyday people, mm-hmm. right? So just even after the passage of the Stamp Act, there was an immediate, visceral reaction of colonial New Englanders to the passage of the Stamp Act. And they, you know, they protested. They rioted. Mm-hmm. They actually even literally tore down the homes of tax stamp collectors. And of course, they tarred and feathered a few as well. And this was not done by, you know, this was not done by the Adams cousins. It Right. was done by ordinary, everyday people. And what's also extraordinarily remarkable, and I've read, and some of this is in my book, mm-hmm. One of the most remarkable things about the American Revolution is that the primary philosophic ideas that influenced people like, you know, the John and Samuel Adams and Otis, and then later Thomas Jefferson and the rest of the cast, is, I mean, they were deeply influenced by the moral and political philosophy of John Locke. But what's also remarkable is that ordinary everyday people who were largely uneducated, hardscrabble farmers were reading Locke's Second Treatise as well. There was kind of to use a metaphor, there was kind of a philosophic tsunami of ideas that crossed the Atlantic and crashed on American shores sometime in the early mid part of the 18th century. And this philosophic tsunami were the ideas of the great Enlightenment, particularly the British Enlightenment thinkers. Most importantly, Sir Isaac Newton in his book, The Principia Mathematica. Mm-hmm. And it was Newton, of course, who had discovered all of the physical laws of nature. And then in the moral and political realm, colonial Americans were deeply influenced by the writings of John Locke, particularly his Second Treatise of Government, which, as I said, was literally being read by ordinary everyday people up and down the Atlantic seaboard and west to the frontier. And so the American Revolution was first and foremost a revolution of ideas. That just swept across American culture, north to south, east to west, over the course of several decades.
Well, I see the interest that you might have in education, particularly about this, given what you just said. And we can look at the newspapers of the time as this kind of fever-pitched publishing industry cranking out broadsheets and newspapers and post bills and everybody reading them and almost like X or Twitter or Facebook gets scoured every day by everybody. Is it kind of a similar or am I overhyping it? Is it a similar kind of interest?
Yeah. No, you're not at all.
Okay. Right?
So, I mean, in addition to reading the major pamphlets of the revolution or of the revolutionary era as I was writing my book, right, I was also reading newspapers, mm-hmm. newspaper essays, what we today call op-eds, and they were literally by, let's say merchants, but literally also farmers, what I've described as hardscrabble farmers living in, for instance, in Western Massachusetts, mm-hmm. in the Berkshire Mountains. There is a collection of writings of these uneducated farmers. Uneducated, by which I mean they did not go to university, uneducated in the sense that they almost certainly didn't even have a high school, what we today call a high school education.
Okay.
They might have been educated only up until the fourth grade or so. And yet these fourth grade educated men are reading, I mean, the three principal books that they, or authors that they would have read would have been the Bible, Shakespeare, and Locke.
Not easy stuff.
Not easy stuff, right?
So they may not have had formal degrees, but they were broadly literate.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Newton. We often, and you mentioned his physical theories, or we look at him as a physicist only. And I've had discussions with students before that putting him in the box of that kind of discipline of physics. In a physics department today, he would not fit in. Strikes me that he was far more, well, today we might say interdisciplinary, but I don't even think that captures it. He's looking for big questions. So how does this person that we might put in a box as a physicist and his discovery of physical laws translate that and inform a question or inquiry about political laws and rights?
Yeah, that's a great question and not an easy one to answer. So think about it in these terms. You know, Newton sees an apple fall from a tree, which sparks the question, how and why does the apple fall rather than rise? And, you know, over many, many years, Newton, with the aid of mathematics, discovers that there are certain natural or physical laws of nature, and that these physical laws of nature are absolute, certain, permanent, and universal, that they govern the entire universe. And that, you know, the sun will always rise in the morning and in the east and set in the west. The tides follow a timeline. All of these things are both predictable and understandable. So in the early 18th century, after Newton's discoveries of these laws of nature, physical laws of nature, a group of moral and political philosophers began to ask the question, well, if there are natural laws of nature, are there natural moral laws of nature? Right? Are there moral laws of nature that are just as absolute, just as universal, just as permanent as the physical laws of nature? And so, and Locke, I think, was probably the most, he was the philosopher who first really began to think seriously and deeply about these questions. In the end, he gave up. Locke himself, as he once wrote in a letter to a friend, his quest was to discover what he called a demonstrable or scientific moral code. Mm-hmm. And near the end of his life, he admitted that he had failed to do so. But many philosophers took up the task after him. And that was really sort of the holy grail of philosophic investigation throughout the 18th century. And if you read the pamphlets, American Revolutionaries, beginning with the Patriots, starting with the beginning of the Imperial Crisis in 1763-64, mm-hmm. up to the Revolution, and then up through the 1780s, there was this fascination with the moral, with discovering the moral laws of nature. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because, you know, that is a kind of turning away, even though virtually all of these revolutionaries were to one degree or another Christians, still there was, I think we can call it, a non-Christian attempt to understand man's moral universe.
That's kind of what Newton is going after too, right? I mean, he's looking for, well, I've often told students, and I think there's some truth to this, that he invents calculus because he's looking for a mathematical expression of the infinite. It's his understanding of how can I determine God's or a creator's role in the physical universe. And so he invents calculus, and that blows their mind, right?
Yeah.
That guy did that to us.
That's right. And there's the same kind of thing going on in the moral realm. So you can see this, for instance, in a really kind of interesting way, in John Adams's diary from the time he was a very young man, starting actually when he was a student, a very young student at Harvard, and then in the few years after he graduated from Harvard, during which time he was actually a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse in Worcester, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And in his diary, Adams, had these long, long entries where, on the one hand, he's literally, in the same way that Newton, was watching apples fall from trees, Adams is observing the physical world around him, and he's observing, he's experimenting, he's trying to understand how and why the world, the physical world, operates as it does. But then he's also doing the same thing in the same way that he's trying to understand the operations of nature, physical nature, he's also trying to understand the operations of human nature. Okay. And in doing that, basically Adams uses a kind of a method, you might even call it a scientific method, not entirely dissimilar to Newton's. And this scientific method is grounded in three methods or procedures. The first is extrospection. That is, you just look out into the world and let's say the human world, and you just observe. You observe how men and women act. And from that, you begin to see patterns in the way they act, for good and for ill. Mm-hmm. And then you also introspect. You turn in on yourself and you examine. It's a self-examination, right? You ask yourself, you know, why did I act a particular way in a particular situation? Like, what was the driving motive for why I acted in this particular situation? And then the third method is history. Mm-hmm. You study human action from past behaviors of people. And so, you know, of course, all of the founding fathers were, they were maybe above all else, they were students of history. They read ancient Greek and Roman history and certainly British or English history. And so from these three sort of methods or techniques, then they were able to sort of induce through a kind of inductive method, they were able to induce sort of laws or rules that they could follow that were supportive of their lives, that, right, they could induce effectively moral laws of human action. And what's remarkable is that, you know, a 22-year-old John Adams was doing that. And at effect, and earlier than that, even 20 years before Adams was doing it, Ben Franklin was doing something similar. So if you read Ben Franklin's autobiography, he has this remarkable chapter on his attempt to attain moral perfection. And you know, if you've ever read that part of the autobiography, there's the so-called Franklin chart, right, where he establishes, I think, 13 virtues.
Yeah.
In a chart, going down the left column and across the top right are the days of the week, and then he takes one virtue per week and records in this Franklin chart. All for every day, let's take the virtue of honesty, right? He would record over the course of 7 days the number of times that he had been dishonest.
Yeah.
Over the course of a week. And then the next week it would be temperance, right? It was the world's first 13-step program.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, to with the purpose of achieving moral perfection. And so what you do is you go through the 13, it's 13 weeks because there are 13 virtues. And then at the end of the 13 weeks, then it's rinse and repeat. You do the same thing over again until you get to the point where on your what we call the Franklin chart, there were no dots representing, right, the number of times you've been dishonest.
Infractions.
Infractions, precisely.
So, yeah, but that doesn't go very well, right? Doesn't he give that up after a few weeks? He's like, this is a waste of time, or there's no way to do it without... I mean, he's an imperfect human being, so of course he's going to have infractions.
Of course. Yeah. But what's interesting is he admits the two things. He admits that he never achieved moral perfection, and we certainly know that would be the case later in his life. Yeah. And he also said, though, that he put the Franklin chart. There was like he had a little black notebook. And each page of the notebook had the chart, right? So each page represented a 13-week program. And there would be, let's say, 100 pages in a particular book. So he's got 100 weeks of this program. And he said he carried his little black book with him his entire life, which is remarkable. Whether he was actually, you know, recording his vices is not totally clear.
I want to get back to what they thought they discovered. In your book, you kind of hammer home rights, consent, revolution. Well, the major play that rights and consent make, and people have been talking about natural rights, well, since Cicero, since the first century in one way, shape, or form, maybe even earlier. But I think your book, you state why that becomes kind of broadly accepted across the American mind, as you say, And as Adam said, because of the newspapers, the broadsheets, the literacy rates, education, and so forth. But it seems there's one other factor, and we've kind of broached on that. What are the preachers talking about in church?
Well, this is also very interesting. So, you know, I have not even come close to doing, you know, any kind of exhaustive survey of sermons during the Revolutionary era. But in fact, just the last 2 days, there's a big, I don't know, 800-page volume of sermons from the Revolutionary era. And I'm sure that's only a fraction. But these sermons, though, are at the very least, they're the ones or some of the ones that were focusing on the political issue of independence. Because obviously, you know, during the Revolutionary period, not every single sermon was concerned with the patriot cause.
Sure.
They did have, you know, they were more concerned with, you know, the eternal cause. Mm-hmm. But what is truly remarkable about many of the sermons, at least those that were discussing the issues of the time, is the degree to which they were obviously, self-evidently influenced by Locke, by John Locke. And so, you know, typically what these sermons would do is, I don't mean this to sound demeaning or condescending, but the sermons, you know, would begin by analyzing a passage from the Bible. Mm-hmm. But then it would very, you know, after sort of some perfunctory remarks about the Bible, then it would turn to the issue at hand, which was the imperial crisis and Britain's passage of all of these, from the American perspective, unjust laws. But it would do so from not a religious perspective, but rather from the Lockean perspective.
Okay.
Right. So, and they're using these ministers the ministers obviously had clearly read Locke. In many cases, they're directly quoting Locke by name, sometimes quoting Locke not by name. And they're using all of the language in Locke's Second Treatise of Government. So, you know, you mentioned the four major principles that I take out of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration refers to them as the self-evident truths.
Yes, okay.
Of the Declaration. And there are four self-evident truths discussed in the Declaration. The first is equality. All men are created equal. The second is the doctrine of rights. The third is the principle of consent. And then the fourth is, though this word does not appear in the Declaration, it's revolution. The Declaration's logic in laying out the four self-evident truths is drawn entirely from Locke's Second Treatise. I mean, the Declaration of Independence maps onto Locke's Second Treatise. And so, I mean, all those, the four principles, equality, rights, consent, and revolution are all enunciated in Locke's Second Treatise. And these ministers, either directly or indirectly, are all using Locke's concepts. I mean, the number of times the words equality, rights, consent come up in these sermons is remarkable.
Okay. So they're not necessarily basing all those. I mean, all those ideas have a notion in the Old and the New Testament. But you say they kind of cast them in the terms of Locke rather than, so it's a non-biblical inspiration, non-biblical language. They're not quoting chapter and verse from the Bible. They're using Locke's language.
Well, both. And so they would use Locke to support the Bible, and then they would use the Bible to support Locke.
Okay. Okay.
Right? And typically the way it would work is that the Locke part would be right in the middle.
Okay.
Right? They begin with Scripture and they would end with Scripture. But really, the heart and soul of the argument was the Locke.
Do you think that's part, I mean, not everybody's a Christian, even in the colonial days. Do you think that's what led to its broadened popularity, was that you could believe whatever you wanted, but this became kind of a secular faith, the Lockean notion of, of rights and equality and consent?
Well, this is the hard thing to sort of figure out.
Because there's no math for this, right? I mean, Newton's, there's no calculus for the, there's no, maybe your next step as a political scientist is come up with a calculus, and a metaphor, at least, for this, as opposed to the actual math for these rights, or for these observations that Adams and others were taking.
Calculus of consent.
Yes.
Something like that.
If Isaac Newton can watch the apple fall from the tree and say, it falls to the tree 100% of the time, what's the law, what's the natural law of that? And he can kind of discern that and come up with equations that mathematically express gravity, force, physics, and so forth. These thinkers, John Adams and the colonists at the time, are largely agreeing that there is a law to equality, rights, consent, and that the king has violated it. But there's no mathematical expression for that. There's just the practice of it. And the kind of the moral, like they've been harmed, right? As an attorney would say, what's the remedy for the harm you've caused me? And this has probably sent economic historians down the path of understanding a revolution in economic terms. But if we're gonna understand the revolution in moral terms, well, and you get to it in the epilogue, which maybe this is a good segue into discussing your epilogue, which I found to be really rewarding to read. They wanted to come up with a truth, and there's an assumption that truth exists, right? Materially, we can map out what makes satellites orbit the Earth, and all that kind of was helped along largely by Isaac Newton. What helps us along in our political life, understanding rights, consent, equality, when there's no agreement about what truth is? And that fuels a lot of our debates today. We have to argue about what truth is. How would they see a moral guidepost versus a relative morality? What would John Adams think of, say, and you get into it in the epilogue of your refreshing discussion of Hegel.
So actually, let me begin with the epilogue, and then I'll go back. So the epilogue to the book was an attempt to explain how Americans in the 19th and 20th centuries have understood the philosophy contained in the Declaration of Independence. And I mean, one of the remarkable things that I think I discovered along the way is that the first critics of the Declaration of Independence were antebellum Southern slave owners. Mm-hmm. And they were, of course, trying to justify the institution of slavery. And to do that, they have to criticize the core principles of the Declaration of Independence, particularly the principles of equality, rights, and consent, and just even the very idea of freedom. And so it turns out these antebellum Southern slaveholders, they came under the philosophic influence of 19th century German philosophers, in particular Hegel. Mm-hmm. And Hegel was what we might call a historicist. That is, Hegel did not believe in the idea of that. In effect, he did not believe in the idea of nature. That is, a fixed nature governed by laws of cause, governed by the law of identity and the laws of cause and effect. For Hegel, history, the study of history is actually not so much the study of the past, but it's the study of the future. It's the study of man's evolution toward a predetermined end. Yes. And that predetermined end is what Hegel referred to as the last man and the last society. Like, history has history has an endpoint. Hegel and his followers rejected the idea that there were absolute, certain, permanent, universal truths that were fixed and unchanging. Instead, they introduced the idea that truth is relative to time and place. When applied by, say, Southern slave owners, What this means is that they began to argue that the principles of the Declaration of Independence might have been true, the truth of the Declaration might have been true for 1776, but they were not true for 1840 or 1850. And the Southern slaveholders, they rejected categorically the principles of the Declaration of Independence down the line. Mm-hmm. They rejected them, and they developed a much more what we would call collectivistic philosophy. In fact, one of them, George Fitzhugh, goes so far as to describe the Southern plantation as the beau, what he called, quote, the beau ideal of communism. And then what's
had he read Marx?
It's not clear whether he had actually read Marx, but I do think he had read some of the maybe some of the pre-Marxian socialists. Probably Fourier and Saint-Simon and people like that. I'm not sure actually whether he read Marx. And then, you know, fast forward to the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and you get progressives like the philosopher John Dewey and political theorist Herbert Croly, and then politicians like Woodrow Wilson. And interestingly enough, they have essentially, these liberal progressives adopted a moral political philosophy very similar to the Southern slaveholders. Mm-hmm. Right, and they too completely rejected the idea, the ideas, the principles of the Declaration of Independence, and in many cases for the very same reasons.
Right.
They just developed a different kind of collectivism than did the Southern slaveholders, but it was collectivism nonetheless. Now, mm-hmm. let's go back in time to the Revolution and to the Founding Fathers. When the Declaration of Independence says we hold these truths to be self-evident, they meant it. They did not understand the concept truth in the way that we in the 21st century understand the concept of truth. You know, the Oxford English Dictionary in 2016 declared the word post-truth, right, to be its word of the year. America's founding fathers did not believe in a post-truth society in the way that many 21st century Americans do. They believed that there was a thing, truth, and that mm-hmm. truth is absolute and permanent and universal. The task is to discover it, right? That's the philosophical task, is to discover it, right? And so, you know, that's why the principles of the Declaration were considered to be absolute. Right. And let's take the doctrine of rights. The doctrine of right, individual rights, was considered to be the rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness were considered to be absolute, and not that they were a no-go zone for governments. And they did not see them as did the pro-slavery thinkers and then the later progressives as evolutionary. As mm-hmm. something that change and grow with time. Instead, they were fixed because they were true.
Is this the kind of thinking that informs Calvin Coolidge's address of July 4th, 1926? I read that several months ago now, and where he talks about laws are to be discovered and that the Declaration of Independence is an end to strive for. It's not something to progress from, if I recall that correctly.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah, so for your listeners, if they've not read Coolidge's speech on the Declaration, they really should, because it's fabulous. Mm-hmm. And he may be the only 20th century president to really fully and deeply understand the principles of the Declaration. And he was absolutely right about how the founders understood this, as was Abraham Lincoln. Right, yes. Abraham Lincoln said that the principles of the Declaration of Independence, they represent an ideal toward which we must always strive as a people, right? And though we may never perfectly attain the ideal of any one of the principles, that is the end. It's not the beginning. It's the end. So
yeah. You talk about, well, I think on a couple of occasions you mentioned that one of the blinders that somebody may, listening to our conversation, may say, well, what about if they were such a free society, how did they have slavery? And you make the point in the book, and others have made this too, that no one ever uses the Declaration of Independence to defend slavery. And in fact, when Hegelianism comes over across the Atlantic, they use all the methods, slaveholders use all the methods at their disposal to try and diminish the Declaration of Independence. Would you say that that's the case?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Declaration of Independence and let's call it the American Revolution, these are the single greatest forces for mm-hmm. abolitionism, the abolitionism of slavery that were ever written. Certainly the Declaration.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the, what we might call the abolitionist document.
Yeah.
And it was treated so in the 1830s by William Lloyd Garrison, the founder of right. the abolitionist movement.
And Frederick Douglass. I think you make the point.
Oh, absolutely.
Too, well, and there's Martin Luther King. You don't bring up King, but I think he uses the Declaration all the time to justify the civil rights movement and so forth.
He does. And it's only after, of course, the Declaration that the states, the northern states, begin to gradually abolish slavery. Had there been no revolution, it's not clear that there ever would have been any kind of abolitionist movement. Because even the British abolitionist movement was influenced by the principles of the Declaration of Independence. So the, you know, beginning in the early, well, really actually soon after the passage of the Declaration of Independence, northern states begin this process. It's approximately a 25-year process of gradually abolishing slavery. And so that by the end, I think 1803, slavery was now effectively ended in the North.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in every single instance, in every one of these northern states that abolished slavery, it was done so on the principles of the Declaration of Independence. So the same is true. It's the ideas of the Declaration that are behind the prohibition of the extension of slavery into the Northwest Territory.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though the Constitution has these clauses which seem to institutionalize slavery, you know, I mean, the ending of in the Constitution, the ending of the international or the, at least the slave trade in 1808. I mean, I think that has to be read as a pro-freedom clause in the Constitution.
If some folks may charge they had blinders on about slavery in 1776, what might our blinders be today regarding moral, political issues that have yet to be resolved? as a political science of capitalism, I'm thinking of the nation's debt, I guess, comes to mind. But
sure. I mean, the nation's debt. There are lots of the nation's debt, the size of the federal government, the size of both the federal and state governments.
Yeah,
would all be examples. I mean, how would the founding fathers, the authors of the Constitution, understand, for instance, the Department of Education? I mean, this is just beyond the what they ever would have considered possible for the federal government. But I would say that the two most important philosophic, since I've written a book on sort of the moral causes of the revolution, I would say that if you had to identify two ideas that dominate Western culture today, it would be these. The first is the idea of nihilism, which is the mm-hmm. idea of hatred of the good for being the good, as the novelist philosopher Ayn Rand once said. And then the second is the Marxian idea, which I think is the core. You could sum up Marxism in one phrase. It would be this, taken directly from Marx: from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Mm-hmm. That is at the heart of Marxism. It's at the heart of communism, of socialism, of liberal progressivism. And these two ideas, nihilism and Marxian socialism, I think are the two fundamental core ideas that have to be fought and that are anti-freedom, anti-civilization in many ways. Mm-hmm. And they work in tandem together. Nihilism is the means and Marxian socialism is the end. Nihilism is the philosophy of destruction, right? It's to destroy culture. I mean, the so-called 1619 project, which argues that the American that America was founded in slavery, and therefore in sin, and therefore America is immoral and evil. The 1619 project is an inherently nihilistic movement. The idea is to destroy and undercut the core values of the United States, and to teach children in particular to hate their country. I'll conclude by paraphrasing Abraham Lincoln, you know, who said, Lincoln said, a house divided cannot stand. And I will say, relative to nihilism and the 1619 project, that a nation that hates itself cannot stand.
Right.
And nihilism is the philosophy of hatred.
It is. Well, Brad, we could probably go on and on, but I think you and I both have other obligations, so I'll end it here. Just recommend the title of the book that we've been discussing today is C. Bradley Thompson's 2019 book, America's Revolutionary Mind, A Moral History of the American Revolution and the Declaration that Defined It. Brad, thanks for coming on History 605.
Ben, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.